Welcome to Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, a podcast for students by students, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
I would just say to anybody who's interested in podcasting to just get going on it, you know, like just get started.
Welcome to Measuring Success Right. My name is Grant Frazier, and I am our host for today. Today's guest is Diana Douglas. Diana Douglas is an independent podcast producer who has created podcasts for Slate, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and most recently created the series Zion Suffragists for Deseret News. Before becoming an independent producer, Diana reported, produced, and edited for public radio for over a decade, at Morning Edition and on the national desk for NPR. She has covered major news stories from the field, including Hurricanes Katrina, Ike, Gustav, and Rita, the collapse of the Big Branch mine in West Virginia, the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, and countless presidential primaries and elections. She's won an Edward R. Murrow Award for her coverage of Ebola in Dallas, a Salute to Excellence Award from the National Association of Black Journalists for her reporting on gun violence among teenagers in Chicago, and a DuPont Columbia University Award for her coverage of the Iraq War from Baghdad. She produced a series about new research on the science of spirituality and an investigative series about polygamy in Muslim American families, both winners of the Gracie Award. Diana Douglas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Grant. How are you?
I'm doing well. We're so excited that you're here. I mean, just reading through your bio, you have done so much that it's truly a blessing and an honor to have you on the podcast. So, Diana, I want to spend a lot of time today talking about the podcast that you just recently came out with last year, Zion Suffragists. But before we get there, I want to be able to give our listeners a bit of background on you by talking about one of your previous experiences that I found fascinating, which is you embedded with the 101st Airborne Division in Kandahar to cover the surge of American troops in Afghanistan and worked as the NPR Baghdad Bureau Chief during the surge of troops in Iraq. So that's an incredible and seemingly harrowing experience. So I was wondering, how did that experience of covering Iraq and Afghanistan on the ground come about? What was it like? And what lessons or experiences do you feel like you gained from that time as a reporter?
So I was thinking about this because, you know, we had talked about talking about this. Mm-hmm. And every time I think about going to Iraq and Afghanistan, I just keep going back to the Jerusalem Center for Near Eastern Studies, which I went to when I was an undergraduate at BYU. And
oh, wow.
It was like my first exposure to Islam, to the Arab world, to Arabic. You know, I took a couple of like very rudimentary Arabic classes there. And I just got a sense of how multifaceted the, you know, this part of the world that is always so flat in news reports is, right? And so, you know, I had just started at NPR. I was a production assistant, a temporary production assistant on Morning Edition. And I started asking the foreign desk if they needed people in Baghdad. I mean, there were so many people covering the war at that point, and it was just really, you know, all of the best reporters and correspondents and just everybody. It was just really the A team, and they were like, "We do not need a production assistant out there, like somebody who's like has no experience in a war or even reporting from the field." I mean, all I could do at that point was just cut tape and put, you know, just like put little short snippets together for, you know, like these like various sections of the broadcast for Morning Edition. So
okay.
I just kept begging, and I think I finally wore them down. And so I went to Baghdad twice, and each time the, you know, you sort of do tours. And so the tour would be like 6 weeks in, and then you would come out, and then, you know, somebody else would go in for 6 weeks, and then I would go back in for 6 weeks. And I have to say, it was a much more difficult experience than I was prepared for. Just like thinking about the war all the time, it was really difficult. So, yeah. and then Afghanistan, we can, you know, I could talk about that later. It was sort of different. I mean, I went to Iraq in 2006 and 2007, which was the middle of the surge of troops. I don't know, you probably don't remember, but the war was not going very well in 2006 and 2007. And so the president, George W. Bush, decided to really send in everything, just to throw everything that we had at it and try to turn things around. And I think people could see that public opinion was sort of turning against the war. So there was this huge influx of American troops into the area. And yeah, and we were, you know, just trying to cover what that was like for people in Iraq, in Baghdad. And then in 2010, a similar thing happened in Afghanistan. the president at that point was Barack Obama, and mm-hmm. he had just inherited the war in Afghanistan and decided to throw everything he had at that. And so it was this period when the number of troops in Iraq started to go down and the number of troops in Afghanistan started to go up until there were finally more troops in Afghanistan than Iraq. And at this point, the U.S. has been involved in foreign wars for 8 years. And it's just such a difficult time to even get people to pay attention to these wars. People's attention had moved on, you know. So there was this huge surge in Afghanistan, and we decided to cover it, you know, like with the military, like from the perspective of the military. And it was the same thing. I think people were a little bit unsure about sending a woman out there, but if there's someone willing to go, sometimes all you can do is raise your hand and be willing to go. I will say it was an incredibly difficult experience.
I just
found myself the only woman everywhere I turned. Do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, mm-hmm. the U.S. troops, mostly men that we were embedded with. You know, all of the people that were there as support for them, you know, like running the bases, all men. And really, the only people that we saw in Afghanistan were also men. You know, women are really, at that point especially, they were just really hard to come by, you know? So mm-hmm. I found that it was sort of an isolating experience, and the only thing I could do was really just put my head down and work. So, because there was just nobody to hang out with, you know? So we definitely got a lot done in the time that I was embedded with the 101st Airborne Division as far as covering the war. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a hard gig, and I don't know. I feel like at this point in my life, I'm not ready to go back to any war zones. Maybe when my kids are out.
You've covered enough. You've covered multiple war zones. That's more than most of us do.
Right. And I also hope that we're not going to be involved in many more wars. So,
yeah. Fingers crossed.
In fact, I just read today that we're, you know, just trying to draw down the troops from Afghanistan again. I mean, we've been trying to do this for 20 mm-hmm. years now, and I don't know, wars are complex, and I think it's really hard to tell a story about a war, especially 8 years or 10 years or, you know, 20 years after it started, in a way that people are interested in. That was a real challenge for us. We had to really find the human side of it and really find a you know, like something new to tell about it. So
So that was something that I was going to ask about, because I am 20 years old. So this is all, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan
are
were
as
something
old as
that,
you are.
They are as old as I am. And so I have had to go back, you know, kind of a little bit after the fact, or much later into the whole war, I've had to go back and try and understand it. And boy, is it really, really difficult to comprehend, just looking all the way back to, I mean, its origins in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask, like, what are the tools that you use as a reporter to try and make those stories more engaging, especially after it just feels like you're beating people over the head for so long trying to talk about it? I don't know. I just wonder how you can, what tools you had at your disposal to try and make it interesting.
The more that you can talk about people, and the more that you can connect to emotions. So this is actually a rule for journalism in general, is that you need to mm-hmm. tell stories where people have something at stake. Okay. So, you know, like if we were telling a story about, you know, the surge in Kandahar, if we started by talking about a car bomb and a roadside bomb killed this many people, injured this many people, it would immediately, like, even as I'm saying this, I'm sure your mind is turning off. You're just like, boring, you know? but if we talked about, you know, like, soldiers, troops, Marines coming in with something at stake, trying to do something, failing at it, succeeding at it in different ways. I mean, I don't know. I just feel like anytime I can tell a story where somebody has something at stake, people are going to listen, you know? Even trying to retell the story of the Utah suffragists in the 1870s, mm-hmm. you know, it's like they had so much at stake. This was life and death for them.
Absolutely.
But it just can be so cut and dry and so boring if you don't help people understand that. I don't know. I mean, it's complicated to tell a story about a whole war. It's easy to tell a story about a person who is trying to do something at great cost to themselves and, you know, is like throwing everything that they've got at it and succeeding and failing. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think that's really interesting. And I'm grateful that you said that, because I did want to talk a lot about Zion suffragists today, because it's been in my head for the last 2 days. I've had the chance to listen to the first four episodes now, and I am just in love with the podcast. So I think what was interesting to me is that Well, first off, I want to stress that the miniseries is phenomenal. You produced and hosted it. And as someone who's lived in Utah my whole life and who has grown up a member of the church, I sort of anticipated going into the podcast that I would already know a lot of it. I guess for some reason I thought that I understood the story of the movement. But honestly, almost everything that I heard in this series was completely new information to me. So
yeah.
Before we get into it, I just wanted to ask if you'd be able to briefly explain to our audience about the series.
What's going on? Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely.
Your experience with this history was exactly my experience with this history. I was born and raised in the church and went to Sunday school and Relief Society and primary my whole life and never once heard the name Emmeline B. Wells or Martha Hughes Cannon or any of these incredible women. You and I have both discovered the same history and have found it totally fascinating.
That's awesome. I love it.
I kind of saw this new openness and curiosity about polygamous history in the last maybe 5 years, and I got swept up into it too. So this is right around the time that the Supreme Court says that gay marriage is legal in the United States of America, and I suddenly saw this new curiosity about other ways of arranging families and an interest in that history too. And so I started to get exposed to people doing research like Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, you know, this Harvard professor who's doing research about polygamy and how it affected women and how it affected their interest in pursuing women's rights, right? So I just fell in love with every story that I came across, and I just found these women they were so tough, like just so tough. Hmm. Let's just give you a quick bird's eye view. In the 1870s, the United States government is trying really hard to stamp out polygamy in the Utah Territory and failing in every way. And the United States is also going through this period of questioning about who deserves the right to vote, right? So these two things are happening at the same time. How can we stop polygamy? Also, who should be able to vote? And the New York Times has this clever idea. Hey, if you want to stop polygamy, let's let women in Utah vote. And then they'll vote against the polygamous men in charge and they'll free themselves from this horrible sort of marriage situation, and then we've solved two problems. We've let women that aren't really American women because they're out there in the territories vote, and we've stopped polygamy. And women in Utah heard this idea and absolutely loved it and started petitioning for the right to vote and got the right to vote kind of on a whim. You know, it was like, okay, we can give this a shot. And they immediately started voting. And so here we are, 1870, no women in America have ever voted under an equal suffrage law. And in Utah, of all places, they start voting. And they start voting, you know, like in the first election, which was held on Valentine's Day of 1870, you know, I think a dozen women voted. And by that fall in the general election, thousands and thousands of women voted. And they did not vote at all the way that people in New York and Washington wanted them to. They were independent voters and they thought the way that they wanted to. And they did not vote against Brigham Young and sort of his theocracy out in Utah. And so the U.S. government stripped Utah women of their right to vote. So after 17 years, they lost the franchise. And wow, if there is something that can really get you fired up, it's to have a freedom and then have it taken away. And so women in Utah just joined forces with Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, all of the suffragists, you know, like sort of working in the East for women's suffrage, and started to do this massive campaign to try to get their own right to vote back and then try to expand the franchise to other women in the United States. So they got women in Utah got the right to vote back when Utah got statehood in 1896. And then they did not stop when they got their own right to vote back. They started pushing for a universal women's suffrage amendment to the United States Constitution, and they finally got it in 1920, a full 50 years after Utah women first started voting. So there were generations of women who had been in this fight, and they were led by the Relief Society. The Relief Society was absolutely the organizing tool for pushing out this women's rights agenda, okay? And so the Relief Society joined forces with like the National Organization for Women and, you know, like all these organizations that now we sort of raise our eyebrows at. But at that point, they're like, we are here to bring women equality with men. I just loved reporting this story. I found so many women that I look up to so much. In fact, before I started doing this podcast, I was podcasting for The Atlantic, the magazine, and I had some quotes by Emmeline B. Wells up on my cubicle, you know, just to remind me, like, you're not alone. There's a lot of women that have come before you who are, like, they're at your back, you know, like, pushing you forward. So,
I really do love that. And I remember as I listened to the podcast, there was one story that really stuck out to me, and it was the section about the women from Utah who wanted to attend the World Fair in Chicago in 1893, who wanted to go and present all the wonderful things that Utah women did. And yeah. I remember you mentioning and saying that you loved this particular speech from Margaret Salisbury, where she mentioned that, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, like, of the women of Utah, there are 12 who have published books, there are 2 newspapers published by women, and they all employ women writers, there are teachers and physicians who are women, and the women pay a fair proportion of taxes with women-led households as well. And I think something that I found interesting about this speech, and I want to hear your thoughts as well, but something that I found interesting just about this whole movement was the fact that the lives of women in early Utah were really, they felt really empowered, and popular opinion with the articles of the New York Times and the U.S. government and the popular stereotypes across the country, they seemed to depict Utah's women as particularly oppressed or downtrodden or less than woman. So it's like this weird subversion, I feel like, where it's weird that the men are telling the women that they are oppressed. And it's really interesting to me. And I just wonder how you thought about that. And also, did the women's presence at the U.S. World Fair in Chicago, how did that shift that paradigm?
I mean, every little bit, it was always like 2 steps forward, 2 steps back, right? With rights for, and it always will be, I think, you know, like when you're in a minority trying to claw rights for yourself, it, you know, you're really facing an uphill battle. And I really felt that when I was reading some of the stories about, you know, Utah women going to the World's Fair. They were just trying so hard to be seen as equals, not only to the men that were there, but also to the other women that were there. I mean, a lot of women, you know, wrote in their diaries that they felt like they were like a circus act, or that, you know, people were just like so curious to see a Mormon and see a Mormon wife. And by the end of their presentations at the World's Fair, when they talked about, you know, Utah women's accomplishments and their advocacy and their activism, they felt like they weren't seen as less than, but they were seen as greater than, because these were actually women who had the right to vote and who could hold public office and who were running for public office. And that was a privilege that people in New York and Boston didn't have, you know? So yeah, I would just say it's a universal struggle to try to find, you know, to try to find basic acceptance and respect from the mainstream society. And it, I will say, it is also something that Utah women face today. You know, I mean, this is not a gone struggle, you know, like Utah women, like it, I guarantee you, like the minute that I tell people that I have ties to Utah, or, you know, like my mom is from Utah, people are just always like so perplexed. They're like, oh, you seem so normal. Or, you know, like you seem like, surely you're an outlier, you know, in that you have a career, or that you, you know, you seem so intelligent or whatever, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's so unfair. And it's something that I think, you know, like women in the church, Utah women are going to have to keep facing until something massive changes in the culture, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I lived in North Carolina for 2 years in high school. And whenever I would tell anybody I was Mormon, the first question I would be asked was, how many moms do you have?
Right.
And sometimes people were joking, but like often people really didn't know that. People thought that I was supposed to still be dressing like a pioneer. It's just, it's interesting how those stereotypes can persist for so long, and how it really is still a fight, you know, to understand that women in Utah are, I mean, they have the full rights that everybody else does. That's something that, it's really interesting that you pointed that out to me. So next I wanted to ask real quick, just kind of a broad overview, just how do you think that this story, reporting on it, changed your perspective of polygamy? And you had also reported on polygamy in Muslim American families.
Sure.
And I was wondering, like, what the comparison is there, how those might be different or similar, the experiences of those women, and just if you had anything to share there.
Sure. So when I first got interested in, you know, this, the history of Utah women's suffrage, what I wanted more than anything was to get my daughters excited about it, right? I have a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old daughter. And I have my sons too, and I want them to get excited about it too, but whatever. I was just like really yes. wanted my daughters to see people at church who they could look up to, you know? And mm-hmm. so I wrote some children's books, like one about Martha Hughes Cannon and one about Emmeline B. Wells. And I promptly sent them off to Utah publishers and, you know, sort of Intermountain publishers and Latter-day Saint publishers, and got probably six rejections in a row, you know? And I was just, it's so hard to get rejected, you know? And so when I pitched this, I pitched it to the Deseret News, and I also pitched it to KUER, which is the NPR station in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. And what you generally get, I will say, is when you pitch things, you don't even get a rejection. You mostly just get silence. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, that's like, worse. Absolutely.
It is the worst. It's like nobody even bothers to say no. They just don't even bother to respond. Anyway, when Deseret News was interested in it, one of their very first pieces of feedback was, we'd really like to not focus on polygamy. And I thought, you know, it's going to be pretty hard to tell this story without mentioning the fact that, like, mm-hmm. polygamy brought all of these women to their activism, because, I mean, there's actually quite a few reasons, but I mean, the biggest one was that, you know, like, these women's faith was under attack from the U.S. government. And what was under attack was their marriage arrangements, right? And so they were rising up to defend polygamy. Like, to not talk about that, I didn't feel like I could tell the story without mentioning that. And then also, I just felt like this would be just another way in which we would be sort of minimizing these women's autonomy and, you know, like, their sort of wholeness as a person. These people made their choices, you know, and they make them for complex reasons, but they chose polygamy, you know. And let's be clear, mm-hmm. not everybody in Utah did. I think 20% of the men in Utah were in polygamous marriages, you know, because there weren't enough women for every man in Utah yeah. to have multiple mm-hmm. wives. And, you know, like, most of those marriages, of this 1 in 5, you know, that were polygamous marriages, was one man and two wives. So it's not like the mm-hmm. Brigham Young model or the Heber C. Kimball model, or, you know, like these like, no, you know, 60 wife models. Those were the most sensational stories that obviously made it into the Eastern newspapers, but mm-hmm. or the people would publish books about, but that was definitely not the norm. But I mean, I think it's a system worth, you know, like, that's worth investigating with openness and curiosity, you know, like, as opposed to just fear. And I think there's a lot of that in the modern church. There's a lot of reluctance to, you know, to sort of investigate polygamy with curiosity and openness. I think polygamy is one of the reasons that these women were drawn to women's rights. They, you know, like, they had the freedom to divorce if they wanted to, which women in the rest of the country did not have. And they also had other women to help them, right? So, like, these sister wives could help raise children, and you could also have as many children as you wanted. You didn't have to have 12 if you didn't want it. You could have one. I mean, Martha Hughes Cannon had one child, and then she ran for state senate, you know? She was like, one's good. I'm good, you know? I mean, I think she eventually had a second baby. But, yeah, I mean, you could just kind of choose to have the family that you wanted. And then also, I think that when you have, you know, these houses full of women, mm-hmm. you're gonna find that it's a little bit like a sorority. You know, there's kind of this girl power thing going on. And especially the way that women in Utah organized around the Relief Society, they were coming together, just women. They were already organized into wards and branches. And, you know, it was just really easy to spread a message and to, like, to organize women for, you know, like, for activism, because the Relief Society created that already. They already had this structure in place.
That's so interesting to me that, I guess, women in that time outside of Utah probably didn't have nearly the same opportunity to engage with and talk with other women about the suffragette movement, you know?
Yeah, I mean, think about, like, you know, Susan B. Anthony was going from, you know, town to town trying to spread the gospel of women's voting mm-hmm. rights. And, it, you know, it was just like, get one person on board in one tiny, you know, hamlet. Get one person on board in one little, you know, tiny, tiny town. And then, you know, try to keep these people connected with newspapers, or it was just painstaking. And then they get to Utah, and here is this entire organization that is totally dedicated to women, to women's rights, to women's advancement. And, you know, the Relief Society would teach women parliamentary procedure and teach them civics and teach them, when you get the right to vote, here's how you do it. You know, like Sarah okay. Kimball, one of the women who had helped organize the Relief Society in Nauvoo and then also helped run the Relief Society back in Salt Lake. I mean, one of her very first ideas was to suggest that women read the Constitution 6 times so that they would really understand how the United States government was set up and like how they as voters and as U.S. citizens were a part of it, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, I really think that, you know, the way that Utah families and communities were organized was meant to lift women. You know, and why have we buried this history today? Probably because of our discomfort with the way that these women arranged their marriages. You know, I mean, we're willing to talk about Brigham Young because he was a president of the church, you know, mm-hmm. but we just really don't want to talk about polygamy, you know, and so I think that the women have been buried because of it.
Yeah, the fact that we are so uncomfortable with talking about polygamy means that we don't get to hear these really powerful stories of these women who fought and like changed the state of the United States of America, yeah. who fought for women's rights in a really powerful, important way.
Yeah,
I think that's really important. And so before we go today, I'm so grateful and I want to remind everyone that you should go listen to this podcast, Zion Suffragists. We will put it in the show notes of this episode. But before we go, since this is a business podcast, I did want to talk about the fact that you are an independent podcast producer after having been a reporter for NPR for years and a producer for them as well. So I just wanted to know, how did you get into this realm of podcasting? What brought you here? Was it something about the medium or the flexibility? Did you love radio or just what brought you to podcasting?
Most of the great podcasts that are, you know, like in the top 100 in iTunes are created by public radio people, mm-hmm. either by NPR or
giants.
By Public Radio International, PRX. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you think about like the best podcasts that everybody is really into, like Serial or, you know, like they all mm-hmm. come from the public radio universe. And I'd always had a really high opinion of journalists. I mean, I grew up listening to NPR. I trusted them. I thought they were smart. And so I was always interested in doing radio. So when I'm sorry, this is not exactly the question you asked, but I'm going to get there. So when I was in college, I did an internship first at CNN and then at KUER, which is, of course, is the public radio station in Utah. And then I got mm-hmm. this internship at NPR out in Washington, D.C., and I took it. And, you know, like I said, I started as a production assistant after my internship was over. But I had always been drawn to radio storytelling. I really like the intimacy of the medium. I like the way that people are just kind of whispering in your ear. You're just hearing their voices. You can't judge the way they look. You're just listening, you know? And really great radio storytelling is... It's just all around us now. And I feel like a lot of it, like, you know, like where the most innovative radio storytelling is in podcasting, you know? I mean, podcasting is just radio production, you know? Mm-hmm. It just has a different name. But, and, you know, you can get it when you want it as opposed to having to tune in, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's basically the same, but kind of different. It's like the streaming age of radio.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is such a golden age for podcasting. And there's so much interest and there's so much... Like, I just feel like there's so much energy and creativity in this space now. And like, I would just say to anybody who's interested in podcasting to just get going on it, you know, like just get started and don't feel like you need to have a totally captivating podcast. It's like straight out of the gate. This is not medical school. Like the barriers to entry are incredibly low, right? Like if you don't succeed at this, it's not like you have medical school debt to pay off or something. You know what I mean? It's just like all you need to do is press record on your voice memos app and get started, you know, and see what you come up with and then uploading it. And, you know, I mean, it's very easy.
And that's not even that hard anymore. Yeah, absolutely.
It's just very easy. So, mm-hmm. I listen to podcasts a lot. It's been a really, really, really good medium for me. Like the reason that I'm an independent podcast producer now, as opposed to working in, you know, like working for like, you know, sort of a more established media company, is I found that the flexibility is incredible for when you're raising mm-hmm. 4 kids, which I am.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So that's a perfect career then. That's awesome. Do you just record most of it from home?
Let me tell you about Zion Suffragists. I recorded it on my bed, in my pajamas, with my blanket over my head to blast, like to, you know, like to block out the sound.
Wow.
And all of the interviews, I mean, I reported that. I reported that entire six-part series, you know, which goes from 1870 up to 1920 and beyond, because, you know, I really wanted to talk about, you know, like how Native American women got the right to vote in Utah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and also like how African American women in Utah got the right to vote. So it doesn't, it looks, the story of women's suffrage doesn't end in 1920, obviously. But I reported that entire story. That entire six-part podcast from my room, like doing exactly what you and I are doing. I mean, for people who can't tell, you're in Utah, we're talking over Zoom, and I'm just recording myself. Like when I was doing interviews, you know, I didn't want to have a bunch of phone tape because it doesn't sound as good, you know, so I would just tell people, some of them were quite old, I would just tell people, put two phones in your ear, I'll talk to you on this one, and press record on, you know, like on your daughter's iPhone or whatever, and hold it up into your other ear and pretend like you're, you know, like a Wall Street trader or something with two phones in your ear at the same time. And I just got excellent, I mean, excellent sound quality. And I never had to travel to Utah or anywhere, you know? Hmm. And wow. I mean, it's just like the technology is making our lives so easy, you know? So,
really,
yes, I
incredible.
Mean, that's exactly how we put that whole thing together. And then, you know, like I would send the audio files out to, you know, like to a producer who was going to mix it in Utah. And then we would just upload it at, you know, at the Deseret News, and that was that.
Well, I really appreciate that. And as a, so I'm, these questions are a little bit selfish because I'm new to podcasting myself, and I really did want to hear just your advice on it. So
and you're
thank
killing
you for that.
This. I should just say for anybody who's listening that you're in headphones. Like I'm looking at you through Zoom, but you got the headphones. You have like a mic screen. You have something on top of your ceiling blocking out the sound. So yeah, I mean, yeah,
I'm
sound
trying
matters.
To make it really official. But yeah. I should have just gone under my bed, I guess. Apparently,
yeah.
Just put the
just
blanket over my head.
Throw a blanket over your head. And just press record on your iPhone.
Well, now I know. We want to thank you so much for being here, Diana, but we've kept you for so long. We still do want to ask you the question that we close every podcast with, though, which is, what does success mean to you, and how do you measure success in your own life?
Yes. So when I first started being an independent podcaster, I found that like I was getting a lot of silence when I was pitching things. And I still do. Let's be clear, like I'm still like creating podcasts and like, you know, pitching them and just hearing crickets in response, you know. One of my friends said that the way to face this, because I mean, rejection just hurts so much, you know, like every time I would actually get a rejection, I just felt like such a loser. You just feel like everyone around you knows, like she's such a loser, you know. So anyway, one of my girlfriends said, why don't you try to get 100 rejections this year? See if you can get all the way to 100, you know, like make this part of your vision of success, you know?
Interesting. So, okay.
Yeah. So I started counting like how many rejections and I mean, like it's really hard to face it, but if you feel like, oh, this is part of my goal is to get more rejections, then it kind of becomes like, oh, good. I got another one. Oh, good. I can, you know, like count, chalk this one up.
Yeah.
And what's shocking is like, you're not going to ever get a yes if you don't ask the question. You know what I mean? Mm. And I never did reach 100 rejections because I, you know, like Deseret News took the podcast. And so I had to start actually putting it together, you know? But so I have yet to reach 100 rejections in 1 year. But, you know. This year is still young.
There's always next year, I guess. I mean, I don't know that I want to be... Yeah. That's amazing, though. I think that that's a really powerful way to measure success that I would not have expected, but I think it's very insightful.
It's like, are you trying? It's like, if you're trying, then you're winning, you know? So, yeah. And, like, I have this podcast now that I have just put so much into. And it's been hard because, you know, it's the pandemic. My kids are not in school. And, like, you know, it's really hard to carve out time to even work on it. But, you know, I've got this podcast that I've been pitching. And, I just keep getting either silence or the other thing that happens is people will kill you with yes, you know. Let's say that in Hollywood, everyone's like, yes, let's do it. Yes, 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 yes. You know, and then just the movie never gets made, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
That is a great idea. I love this idea. Yes. You know, and then you just
then
always
crickets.
Hear yes.
Mm.
So anyway. So this is like this podcast that I've been working on, a podcast for children. It's storytelling. And it's in English and Spanish. So it's like my first attempt at a bilingual podcast. And Yeah, I'm just like, gosh, if you hit the wall this many times, is it time to, change gears or, you know, like tweak it in some way or like start from scratch. You know what I mean? And I think that like knowing that like Stephen King got 100 rejections and, you know, like J.K. Rowling got, I don't know, 17 before somebody was like, fine, we'll publish your little Harry Potter book, you know? I mean, you hear these stories and you're like, wow, that's tenacity. That's a real feel good story. I sure am going to use that. But then when it actually comes to you facing rejection yourself, it's just a totally different, thing. So
I understand. I'm applying for internships right now. So I feel that same thing. I get the crickets in my inbox, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
No, I totally feel you. And I wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today, Diana Douglas.
Yes. Thank you, Grant, for having me.
All right. Well, this has been Measuring Success Right. I'm Grant Fraser. Thank you all for tuning in, and we will see you all next time.
Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. Be a friend and tell a friend about Measuring Success Right.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review or online at marriottstudentreview.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect official policy or position of Brigham Young University or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.